Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I have to say, I'm such an election nerd that whenever we get to dive deep into propositions, I'm totally into it. And today we've got two of them that we're going to be talking about, one each hour. And hopefully with these very complex propositions in many cases, will help you understand them a little better and have more confidence as you cast your vote on them. That's all coming up today right here on Air Talk. Also, a reminder, Film Week comes your way tomorrow at 11, and I know for many listeners, Film Week is even more valued because we have so much heavy news that's around us in this year of 2020. Thank goodness to be able to talk about movies, which we'll do tomorrow morning at 11 right here on KPCC. But today, we'll jump right in with the latest on the novel coronavirus trials that are going on. There are four vaccines that are, suppose you'd say, in the front runner position. I don't mean it to sound like it's some sort of a sports competition, but into the phase three of the clinical trials. And each of them have specific protocols that they're following to make sure that they're safe and effective. Now, the Wall Street Journal's Jared Hopkins, who's healthcare reporter for the journal, has had a chance to look at the protocols for those four leaders in vaccine trials and to talk with us about some of the process they're going through, the challenges that all these trials face, and more. Jared, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start, first of all, with the access to this information. I'm not aware of previous vaccine studies where there's been this degree of openness to looking at the numbers of participants involved, et cetera. Is this unusual?
Yeah, it's definitely not typical. These protocols, which are basically blueprints or outlines of how a clinical study or a clinical trial would be done for either a vaccine or a drug being developed, is usually kept under wraps. It's considered proprietary information for drug companies. Some of it might come out after a study is finished or after a drug is approved, but generally these types of informations which have, you know, they map out sort of how efficacy will be defined and how many people will enroll in a trial, that generally is not available publicly. It's come out because of COVID-19 vaccines, because of concerns over whether or not the vaccines will be tested thoroughly, robustly, and given the right or the proper sort of scrutiny that the public and many individuals are hoped to have done.
Well, for those vaccines that require two doses, a booster after a given period of time, are the protocols significantly different in those cases, or is it just a matter that it does extend the time frame somewhat?
Yeah, the protocols are all generally the same in terms of information that they might have or that they might describe. Two particular vaccines that I think you might be referring to are from Pfizer, and then another one from a company called Moderna. And they rely on a new sort of gene-based technology, excuse me. And those do require two doses several weeks apart. And then usually a vaccine takes a couple of weeks for it to sort of have the desired effect in the human body. So rather than getting one shot, once you add two shots in there, that adds a little bit more time for the vaccine to sort of take effect and then also for testing to happen.
And what do they need to look for in the number of positive COVID-19 cases and symptoms that develop to determine the effectiveness of the tested vaccine versus the placebo?
Yeah, and so this is what's actually super interesting if you're not following this stuff in the weeds like some of us do who cover healthcare. But in vaccine trials, you just need a fraction of the people who enroll in a trial to actually become sick and then conduct the analysis, and which most people might not realize. But in these trials, which are these late-stage vaccine trials for COVID, are enrolling 30,000 or more people, yet just 150 or 160 individuals actually have to get sick, or in this case, symptomatic COVID-19, to begin analyzing whether the vaccines work or not. So it basically triggers an analysis. You don't have to necessarily wait the 2 years or however long the actual trial might be planned out for.
Can you explain a little bit the math then of how you factor in those in the trial who were using, being injected with placebo versus those who were getting the one or two injections of the vaccine, what that ratio needs to be to prove the efficacy of the vaccine?
Yeah, well, I'll try. Some of it, I mean, a lot of this is actually calculated by biostatisticians and a whole lot of math and stuff like that. But basically, they try to figure out how many events a trial needs in order to draw a conclusion about whether a shot works safely. And they factor in what's known about the vaccine in preclinical data, as well as sort of how a virus, or in this case, COVID, is spreading, so rates of infection. And so it kind of varies. They're kind of taking all this into account and then sort of calculate it. And then once they do the analysis, at this point, and then they sort of figure out what the efficacy should be. In this case, the protocols are calling for at least 50%, around 50% efficacy to determine whether or not it's a success.
Is that an FDA or is that internal to the company's level that they need to hit?
Well, so the FDA has said that it will require for either approval or emergency authorization at least 50% efficacy. And so it just happens that the final analysis for these trials is around at 50% efficacy. Now, an important sort of element here is that before that final analysis, there is what's possible, what's called an interim analysis. And that actually would allow for fewer than the 150 to 160 cases of COVID to prompt an efficacy analysis. The difference is that the efficacy percentage that's required has to be much higher because there's fewer cases. So in a way, the standard is higher, the bar is higher, right? So in Pfizer, for example, they could have an interim analysis starting at 32 cases.
Wow.
However, I believe it's 77% efficacy.
Yeah. So you'd have to show it's so effective that it's just statistically making such a huge impact with that small number of people with COVID. So what have we seen with previous vaccines, for example, with the efficacy rate before it's introduced to the public?
Right. Yeah. And there is a concern about how quickly, these events can be achieved because of the way the spread of the virus and people's behavior. And then also, even if you get to that event, so if you get to 32 events quickly or within a few weeks of a trial starting, there are some scientists and researchers outside of the companies who wonder, well, is that even enough to give the public confidence that a vaccine that is based on 32 events should be authorized and widely distributed and can persuade millions of people to become vaccinated.
We're talking with the Wall Street Journal's healthcare reporter, Jared Hopkins, whose piece in today's journal looks at four of the leading clinical trials of novel coronavirus vaccines and looks at what the standards are for efficacy in those studies. Also, there's been some reporting about some of the side effects that people involved in clinical trials for various vaccines have been experiencing. And with us from UC San Francisco Medical Center, infectious disease specialist and professor, Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Dr. Chin Hong, so good to have you with us again.
Always a pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
What are your thoughts about having such small numbers of COVID symptomatic cases showing the efficacy of a vaccine?
Well, I think overall it depends on how effective the vaccine is, whether or not you look early or you look later. I think most people are saying, I think, that you should kind of wait the standard time. I know that Pfizer wants to look a little bit earlier than everyone else. And, you know, I think the optics of that looks a little bit weird because I think Pfizer is kind of like, you know, the bull in behind the gates. You know, it's like rushing to get out. And the other vaccines are also in Operation Warp Speed, but they're kind of all clustered in kind of a more standardized setting. Meaning that, you know, just a few weeks more, you know, as Jared said from the Wall Street Journal, most are waiting for around 50 cases. Pfizer is going to take an early look at 32 cases. The early look is really it's standard across many studies, not just vaccines. It's standard across drug trials as well, where it may not be ethical to actually keep people in a placebo setting if a vaccine is like amazingly effective. So like there are amazing vaccines out there in the infectious disease world, like the HPV vaccine is like more than 95% effective. But that outcome takes a while to come out, which is like precancer lesions and cancer. So they actually took like 3 years before they can have enough events to really put the data together. They're assuming that in COVID, that they'll be getting enough events fast so that you can see whether or not a vaccine is either just super effective or just regular effective.
Well, and in the competition between these drug makers, efficacy is going to be huge, right? Because, you know, your company could be first to market with an effective and comparatively safe vaccine. But then if someone comes in a little bit later and shows, you know, 10% higher degree of effectiveness, would that not end up, you know, making it difficult for the first one out to compete going forward?
Definitely. But I think in the beginning with COVID, it will be a matter of just having enough shots around to vaccinate everyone. And people may not be as fussy per se in the first round, but you're right. You know, depending on how often we'll need these vaccines, one of the early out the gates, but maybe less effective than a vaccine that comes out later on, may not be the last one standing because we probably would need to get boosters, perhaps. We're not really sure how long the immunity would last.
And how is that studied? How long it lasts? I mean, is that simply from field research? You see which individuals have been vaccinated, and then you look over a year, 2 year, 3 year period of time and see who got COVID-19 for a second time, let's say, if they got it once, got it again, or how do you determine that?
That's a great question. So in many studies, particularly in phase three, when you're looking at 30,000 people, you look to see, and of course, what we've been talking so far is about the early look of the people. But again, they'll be following these people for, in some cases, more than 2 years. So that's mainly for safety, but also for efficacy. So they'll probably be looking at antibody values, et cetera, and see how they wane over time in these participants over certain intervals. But this group, this phase three group, they'll not only, you know, tell us the early results and whether or not the vaccine works in early results, but they'll also be the sentinel chickens, so to speak, so that when they start getting a bad signal, like maybe the antibody effects are waning, hopefully people won't start getting sick in these 30,000 people, then the scientists will say, hey, wait a minute, maybe it means that we need to give another booster. And that's standard again in many vaccine studies. You have the first set of results and then they follow them over time to see if antibodies wane, and is that waning of antibodies associated with more people who actually got the vaccine getting disease now?
And Dr. Chin Hong, are we confident at this point that the antibodies are themselves evidence of protection from the virus?
I think that's the million-dollar question, Larry. So far, we know from the phase 1-2 studies that people make the antibodies. We think these antibodies are going to be protective against COVID, but again, nobody really knows for sure because those were healthy volunteers, and they just look at antibody responses, not whether or not they protected against disease. We hope that they will protect against the real deal disease, and that's what the phase 3 studies will show us. But, you know, we're not, 100% sure yet.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UC San Francisco Medical Center professor and infectious disease specialist, and Jared Hopkins, healthcare reporter for The Wall Street Journal, with a very interesting story in today's journal that looks at the four leading clinical trials for COVID-19 vaccines and the comparatively small number of participants in those trials that need to come down with COVID-19 and show symptoms to determine the effect of the vaccine that's being tested versus the placebo that half the people are getting as well. I was also looking at a CNBC story today, which had a few individuals. These are anecdotal because they're just a few people that they talked to who had taken part in Moderna and Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine trials, who in some cases described what seemed to me pretty serious side effects. Now, not as extreme as many people who got COVID-19 and had to be hospitalized. These individuals didn't. Nonetheless, they described intense chills, fever up to 104. One person described even chipping a tooth from the shivering that went from this. Dr. Chin Hong, these might be, just a very small number of cases of people with that degree of side effects. But how does that complicate trust in the vaccine and the rollout of a vaccine?
Well, I think it's such a complex landscape with trust and the vaccine, Larry. You know, we've talked about sort of the mixed messaging and the political discourse around timelines that sow distrust in the community. I think highlighting these side effects and these stories too also would make people feel a little bit uncertain. But again, it's always a risk-benefit calculus every time you decide to take an intervention. And if the side effect is, of course, all of these side effects are graded by each study. If they're prominent, but they go away, I think everyone will have, and then you'd want to look at what probability is that side effect going to happen in me. And those are the things that you look at. I think there was a recent study as well looking at, interestingly, the Moderna vaccine in older individuals, including those older than 71, and so far in that summary report, it looks like the side effects in the general older population is not very different from the influenza vaccine. So I would encourage folks to not just look at the side effects in isolation with this vaccine, but maybe think of it in the big landscape of how does this compare to other vaccines that people are used to thinking of getting?
And it was notable, even these anecdotal, just handful of, people that were interviewed, all of them said they were totally supportive of vaccination and they just thought people needed to be fully informed. They were concerned as to whether the drug manufacturers should these actually hit the public in mass numbers, that people were fully informed of the side effects, not that they felt that it should, stop the vaccines from being distributed. Jared Hopkins, Wall Street Journal, just back to you. What's the latest on a projected timeline for vaccination being available, perhaps early on, for those most vulnerable to COVID-19?
That's a good question. If I had a crystal ball, I think I'd be doing something else in my life.
what are the companies? What's their most optimistic timeline?
Pfizer has indicated, or Pfizer has said that they expect to have, they expect to know or have an understanding about whether their vaccine has efficacy, or that they have some data results in October. This month. I believe the CEO of Moderna was quoted in a publication yesterday saying that he expects results in November. And then there's another company, AstraZeneca, which is developing a vaccine, but whose trial is currently on hold here due to potential safety concerns in the U.S. And that one, there's questions about whether that would be results now that it's on hold this year. So the question really is potentially there might be results this month or next month. But then after that process, after the results, then there's a whole regulatory process. The results have to go to the FDA. The FDA is going to have an outside committee of experts called an advisory panel look at the results. And then the FDA would ultimately make a decision on whether or not to grant an emergency authorization, either for the general population or a specific subgroup of a population, such as those who are high risk or other individuals.
Or healthcare employees. All right, Jared, thank you. Really appreciate it. Very interesting story. Thank you for joining us. Jared Hopkins, healthcare reporter for the Wall Street Journal, covering healthcare and the pharmaceutical industry. And my thanks to Dr. Peter Chen Hong, who's always so game to come on and talk with us on Air Talk about the latest on COVID-19. Thank you so much, Dr. Chen Hong. We always appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Larry.
Talk with you soon. Coming up, we take a look at one of our important ballot propositions, Proposition 23. Second time voters have been asked about further regulations for kidney dialysis clinics. We'll find out what's involved in this one and how it differs from the initiative of 2 years ago. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk.